Welcome to the Dallas Philosophers Forum. I'm David Alkeck, the president of this organization, and we thank you for coming. May I ask any first-time attendees? Yes?
Oh, wow, good.
Where did you hear from us, or did you know the speaker?
I learned under the speaker. He's my mentor.
The teacher's teacher.
All right. Dr. Benson.
Same thing?
Heard the speaker at Lakewood Library.
Great.
I was there for that.
And?
Me? Oh, he was in the county council.
All right. Very good. Yes, ma'am.
And I hear Paul wherever I can.
Where are you? Follow him around. A disciple. Yes, ma'am.
I can.
Same thing.
Okay.
Yes.
This man right here.
Answer.
Well, I heard
one.
What?
We've heard
both. All right.
We're trying to search down.
More the merrier. All right. A few little things. We are grandfathered here in at El Phoenix. No other new organizations could use this room, so we want to take care of our hosts. Make sure you pay your bill before you leave and tip your food servers. If we have to be politically correct, food servers. So the admission is $5. We do have our expenses. We have to pay for stuff like this. And for a full-time student, it's $2. So you can see our treasurer, David Drum, here. Let's see. All right, so let me introduce our speaker. Oh, by the way, we do have schedules for the rest of the year up until through May, and we have those available. The next speaker on the program is yours truly, and I'll speak about artificial intelligence and the future of medical practice. So our speaker tonight is Dr. Paul Benson. He was born in South Dakota, reared there in the Black Hills. His undergraduate studies were at Pacific Lutheran in Tacoma, Washington, master's from Colorado State University, and his PhD from North Texas University. He's a professor of humanities at Mountain View College, lectures all over the place, well-known. The director of the National Endowment for Humanities Institute, Slavery and the Constitution, right? At the Library of Congress. The winner of 4 national teaching awards. He's called a teacher's teacher. So without any further ado, let's have your hand for Dr. Paul Benson.
Thank you. I appreciate the introduction and also to be here with so many dear friends who I haven't seen in a long time. And those of you I've seen recently, it's a real pleasure to spend a little time with you on a wonderful topic. Why Dallas? Why Dallas has become this great, prominent a city? You just say the name Dallas and people know generally where you're from. And so I want to talk to you about how this may have happened, but I always like to start with the cliffhanger. In other words, I like to get, this is primarily for students who have a tendency to want to slip out somewhere along the line, and so this is hopefully to keep you here. Here's the cliffhanger for tonight, and I want to see if anybody at the end of the program can answer this question. What 3 famous, iconic movements started in Dallas, Texas? Let me repeat the question. What 3 famous, iconic institutions, if you will, started in Dallas, Texas? Institutions here is in quotes. to not be confused with necessarily a physical building or organization. And so you be thinking about that, and we'll come back to that at the end. Now, I had my moment of epiphany on January 1st, 2000. You might ask how I could remember this exactly. But this was what happened on that day. So I woke up that morning, and I wondered if anything had happened dealing with Y2K. Now, before the year 2000 rolled in, for years before that, we heard these terrible predictions about what was going to happen on January 1st, 2000. And so I was wondering, and early in the morning, there wasn't anything on TV, so I thought, I'll go down and get the Dallas Morning News. There'll be something in there. And so I went down to 7-Eleven, and I got the Dallas Morning News, looked at the front page, nothing about Y2K. By the way, I never heard anybody say Y2K since January 1st, 2000. And it was just like, it was an obsession, and it went away. And it makes me realize how Americans tend to obsess over certain things, and as a culture, and it says something about us. But anyway, Y2K surely would be on the front page. Some computer crashing, some business, some airline falling out of the sky because of Y2K. But I didn't see anything, but I took the paper home and I looked through it. And what I found inside the paper knocked me over dead. And this is the front page of what was there. It was the entire newspaper. They had reprinted the whole thing from January 1st, 1900. Unbelievable. And I couldn't stop reading it. It was amazing. And later, when you have a chance, you might want to come up and look at this, because this front page is extraordinary. And then as I just kept finding amazing things in it. So anyway, I looked at it, and one thing in those days, they had advertising on the front page. And so over here it says, Happy New Year's from the Sanger Brothers, which of course is today El Centro College. Happy New Year's from E.M. Kahn, K-A-H-N company, E.M. Kahn. Now, E.M. Kahn was, of course, sold clothing. But E.M. Kahn is really important to those of us in the community college, because his son, Eddie Kahn, who eventually took over the company, named after his father, Eddie Kahn was the man who led the charge in Dallas to create a community college district. So if community colleges can have saints, Eddie Kahn is our saint. And I was interviewing Bill Priest one time, and I said, you're the founding chancellor. Who was the real founder, though, of Dallas County Community College District? He said, well, that's easy, Eddie Kahn. He said Eddie Kahn was the man. He was the driving force behind it and talked everybody else into doing it. And Eddie Kahn that brought him to Dallas to create the Dallas County Community College District. So that's a little plug for the Dallas County Community College District. Anyway, down here it says at the Dallas Opera House they were having a production of something called The Little Host. And then this really got to me, Dallas Cockpit. Dallas Cockpit tells you exactly at 153 Main Street. Cockpit, cockfighting. In downtown Dallas, January 1st, 1900, they were having cockfights. It's completely legal, completely acceptable, and extraordinary in a way how prominent it was here on the front page of the Dallas Morning News. So that tells you a little bit of how things work. So anyway, I'm looking along in here, and I cannot believe all of the articles that are of an international nature. Almost everything on the page from here over is dealing with the Boer War. The Boer War was the battle between the Boers, the Dutch settlers of South Africa, and the British Empire for control of the gold in South Africa, particularly in the Afrikaner states of Orange Free State and the Transvaal. And the British wanted the gold. Now, why did they want the gold so bad? Gold was in 1900 what oil has been, say, near 2,000, 100 years later. It was the must have, or you're going to die, right? And so England was on the gold standard, America was on the gold standard, and they wanted that gold, because without the gold, the economy would collapse. See, the problem with gold is always then there's not enough of it. So you can't expand the economy beyond what the gold supply is. And so that was this war, and it's all about what's happening, column after column, and how upset Germany was, because see, Germany was supporting the Dutch Afrikaners against the British Empire. And it just occurred to me, like a flash of lightning, that the Boer War was kind of a prelude to World War I. It was many of the same issues, and they were both backing each side. Then I read something over here that I thought, I wonder who this is. It says here, and there's a dispatch from Pretoria that says that Baden-Powell's unit is in great danger, and the regiment has already lost all these men, and there's very concern over how Baden-Powell, if he's alive or dead, talks about this. I think it was Baden-Powell, that's a familiar name. Where have I heard that name? Boy Scouts. See, Baden-Powell survived the Boer War, and a few years later created the Boy Scouts. And then, of course, it came across the ocean, became Boy Scouts of America. And then somebody in Savannah had the idea of creating the Girl Scouts. And so now we have to go through the gauntlet of Girl Scout cookie girls standing in front of the supermarkets trying to get in there without getting yet another box of Girl Scout cookies. That's the month of February, so we're soon to be over that ordeal. So anyway, this made me realize, reading this, how very cosmopolitan and international Dallas had already become in 1900. So I want to go through kind of a timeline, if you will, of important things that happened to Dallas that ultimately made the difference for Dallas. And we all know pretty much the story of John Neely Bryan coming in 1861 to build his little trading post on the Trinity River. The reason he built it where he did, which is, by the way, about where the Triple Underpass is, that's about where the cabin was, because the river came up at that time and made a bow. And so just where Dealey Plaza is, you could literally, at one time, very brief time, get on a steamboat and go back down all the way to the coast. And the steamboats, in fact, a number of the people of the famous Peters Colony had come up the Trinity River. The Republic of Texas, the plan was to found 26 cities coming up the Trinity. And so they didn't exactly have a specific idea of where they would settle these, but the Peters Colony people came. And in fact, John Neely Bryant, when he came in 1841, was on the Peters Colony. Now we should digress for a minute here, talk about the Peters Colony. Peters was this real estate guy living in Cincinnati, Ohio, who never came to Texas, but who was very prominent in real estate circles. And the Republic of Texas signed four different contracts with him. The deal was pretty simple. Texas needed people. And he was trying to encourage immigrants to come. And so if, as long as he could keep supplying people, they would come. And so there are many Texas cities that were founded by Peters County people, Hearst, Euless, Bedford, those are all Peters County people. And Farmers Branch was the one of the centers of Peters County. Basically, from Dallas out, way out to, say, Wichita Falls, in a kind of a big triangle. This entire, almost, you know, the big chunk of north central Texas was Peters County. Peters, by the way, along with running his real estate business, had a music store in Cincinnati. And there was a man that used to come in and teach piano to kids. And one day the man came up to Peters and said, "I really appreciate all you've done for me. Let me teach here." And the man said, "Oh, that, no, we're happy to have you. But I want to show my appreciation to you. I've written a song. And here it is. It's yours. Do whatever you want to with it." What's the song? Well, it goes like this. "Oh, I come from Alabama with a banjo on my knee. I'm going to Louisiana, my true love for to see. Oh, Susanna, oh, don't you cry for me. Oh, I come from Alabama with a banjo on my knee." And Peter said, that's a pretty good song. I can have this. "Oh, sure, you can." Of course, the man who wrote it was named Stephen Foster. And Stephen Foster is an interesting guy because folk songs are supposed to be, you know, written by the people. But Stephen Foster was so good at writing folk songs that people always assume they are folk songs because they have that quality about them. And so, you know, any folk song collection is going to have Stephen Foster songs. Anyway, this is the very same Peters that settled the Peters colony, or brought people to Texas, who himself never came. And so John Neely Bryant, the reason he put his trading post where he did is because of the Austin chalk or limestone that was under the river. You could cross the Trinity on a wagon in this for a distance there on the river, because typically crossing the Trinity is a very muddy mess, right? And so there were two Indian traces that came together at Dallas and crossed, and so that's where he put his trading post. Well, as important as John Neely Bryant is, because he named Dallas and one of the enduring historical controversies is who did he name it after? This is not as simple a question as you might think. And so Bryant then was trading with the Indians, and he started selling a few lots. But then in 1849, he got gold fever. He heard about California strikes, so he left. And here the founder of Dallas has just kind of lost history. He did come back, but he was never had much prosperity, let's put it that way. And certainly didn't strike it rich in California. In the meantime, another group come to settle in what is Dallas today. And that, of course, is the famous Lowry Union Group. Now, one reason I want to pause on the Lowry Union Group is because I believe that the Lowry Union Group had quite a bit to do with the culture in Dallas. Let me explain. So in 1848, there was a revolution in Europe. And the liberals, the people who were for egalitarianism and for equality, pretty well got beat up. And many of them from France decided to come to America. There was in France a man by the name of Fourier. Now Fourier was really, we call him a nutcase today, but he had these wild ideas, and he thought that these people should come to America and settle here and form these communistic communities, communism here with a small c, communalistic communities, and live in this area with the intention that they would be a vanguard of egalitarianism. They remember everything in common, everybody equal, everybody the same. So they were called phalanxes. These communities were called phalanxes. So the La Reunion phalanx came and they landed in Galveston. If you can imagine this, their shoes were wooden shoes. These again, gives you an idea of what they had to do. They walked on wooden shoes from Galveston to what is Oak Cliff today, up on the escarpment, up on Chalk Hill. And they were so enamored, they wrote these journals and letters home, because they came through Texas. They landed in about this time of year, and they started north, March and April, and they wrote back, oh my God, the beauty here. The wildflowers are just sensational. And they were so taken by this country, as you can imagine, seeing all those bluebonnets and Indian paintbrushes and so forth. And so they came on. They finally got to Dallas. They realized, as many pioneers realized, they had been cheated. They had thought they had bought 1,000,000 acres. They got really a small portion of that, and it was up on the escarpment, which is all limestone. This is why over the years there have been two major cement plants built along the escarpment, one in Oak Cliff and one down in Midlothian. And these, the escarpment, their idea was, of course, to grow grapes, and then they would have wine, they would sell wine, and this way they would survive. Well, they couldn't grow a darn thing on the escarpment. So to survive, they went down to the Trinity River and took their fish traps and started trapping fish. And if you go over there by Pinkston High School, it says Fish Trap Road. That's the road they walked down from up in the escarpment down to the Trinity and fished. This is kind of unbelievable for us today, knowing what the water of the Trinity is like. But there were a lot of fish, and the fish of the Trinity is what they survived on. If you also go over by Pinkston High School, you'll see the old Colony Cemetery. They're all buried there. It's kind of run down now, long forgotten. But the people, and they did okay until the Civil War came on. And then the Confederate officers came up to the colony and said, well, we need you for the war. They said, we're pacifists. You know, we don't believe in war. Well, that's too bad, because you gotta sign up. And so what they did is just basically break up and, you know, disperse and try to hide as best they could. And so most of them wound up in Dallas. And Dallas, is the place where they settled. Probably the most famous name that you would know is Rivershawn Park. But they went to Irving and they went to Grand Prairie, and they just settled around different places. But they were, so many of them were musicians and artists and craftsmen. So they brought this tradition of art and culture to Dallas from the very beginning. And this is one of the reasons, I believe, Dallas got started out with this idea that it's a place of culture, right? Amon Carter, 1936, had a sign right outside of Fair Park where they had the famous Texas Centennial celebration. And it said, and then Amon Carter, of course, built his own celebration, his own festival in Fort Worth called the Frontier Exposition, 1936. And the big sign said, Dallas for culture, Fort Worth for fun. Okay. So even Amon Carter, as much as he hated Dallas, had to admit that Dallas was a place of culture. Now, he also had another sign that said 30 miles to Whoopi. Because there was a famous Sally Rand nude ranch as part of the Frontier Exposition. Sally Rand, of course, the famous stripper, if you will. And she made a fortune in those days at the Frontier Exposition. and went on to 1939 Chicago World's Fair, and so on. By the way, Dallas should have had a World's Fair. Should have been called World's Fair. Certainly as big as any World's Fair at that time. But R.L. Hork said, we'll never call it World's Fair because that'll take away from the word Texas. So it'll be the Texas Centennial. 100 years of Texas history. Think about it. 1836, Texas became an independent country, right? And for almost 10 years, it was an independent country. No other state has anything like Texas in this way. It was an independent country that became part of the United States. So it has this kind of sense of nationality and pride that's very unique among states. So we celebrate not from when Texas became a state. Nobody remembers when that was. We celebrate 1836, 1936, and then 2036. So the last big one was the sesquicentennial here, 1986, yeah. But anyway, get back on the trail here. So there was another interesting connection here. Fourier, the Frenchman, sent these groups to the United States, and one he sent was to Wisconsin. Now, in Wisconsin, they had the same ideas of equality, fraternity, of treating people, everybody treating life. And they, of course, were very upset over the concept of slavery. Slavery did not fit in with their idea, with their vision. So one day, in the middle of 1850s, there was a Frenchman in the Wisconsin Phalanx, in the city of Ripon, Wisconsin. And he said, I want to have a community meeting, and the reason is we need to get a political action group going that will promote the idea of abolition. And this was, of course, pretty controversial, but he said, I'll invite all the Frenchmen here, and then we'll get some community people, and we'll all meet in the Little White Schoolhouse. So if you go to the Little White Schoolhouse in Ripon, Wisconsin today, there's a sign out, historic sign outside that says, Birthplace of the Republican Party. Now, I think it's ironic that the foundation of the Republican Party was with these French communists and France. Who were preaching equality, fraternity. And so this is the very same group that was here in Dallas, the La Reunion group. Now, the thing that happens is this. Dallas isn't much of anything, really, during this period. When the Civil War came, Dallas voted into the Confederacy. The few people that were here had tended to come from the South or from Tennessee and Kentucky, and they tend to have Southern sympathies. But it was certainly not anything of great significance. I mean, little towns like, Denison were actually bigger. Waxahachie, for goodness sake, was bigger than Dallas. Dallas was just another place on the frontier. But Dallas had something, or had more of something than most cities had, boosters. See, back in the 1800s, boosterism was very big. And they were always trying to promote the city. And so it had these boosters. And these boosters were primarily interested in getting the railroads here. So in 1872, the Houston, the railroad from the south, comes up to Dallas. This is a great breakthrough. But the boosters had a plan to get in legislation that would require the East-West Railroad, the Texas and Pacific Railroad, in 1873, to come within 1 mile of Browder Springs. They got that written into the law. Now, Browder Springs, we know, Old City Park. It was, at one time, kind of the center, the first water supply that Dallas ever had was Browder Springs. And so Browder Springs is really important to, in this story, because by going 1 mile to near Browder Springs, they had to come right through Dallas. So the main line from the south, from Houston, and the main east-west railroad then come together in Dallas. And that is the first really big impetus for great growth anytime you have two railroads coming together. Now, I'd like to mention to you that in the late 1800s and early in the 20th century, Dallas was the world center for, at one time, cotton. More cotton was growing, came out of the cotton exchange in Dallas, anywhere. That's why they called it the Cotton Bowl, because this was the center for a while of the cotton world. Now there's probably any cotton within 100 miles of Dallas. But it was very, very big at one time. Leather and buffalo hides. See, before Fort Worth became Cowtown, Dallas was Cowtown. There were just dozens and dozens of saloons and red light districts and all of that that moved over to Hell's Half Acre and moved, and the whole cow industry moved over, but that was about 10 years later. So for a while, Dallas was the headquarters of the buffalo hide and leather industry. Saddle making, number one, in Dallas for a long time. And here's an amazing one. Cotton gin manufacturing. We don't think of Dallas as a manufacturing center, but it certainly was for cotton gins. And in fact, the cotton gin factory, the big one, the biggest of them, is probably down there near Baylor Hospital. And they, you know, it's all been turned into lofts now and this kind of thing. Cross street from the Sons of Herman Hall. We forget the important influence of the Germans that moved to this area. Large numbers of Germans that came. So Dallas is then starting to grow. And by the time we get to 1900, it's a city of significance. The Dallas Morning News had moved up here from Galveston. And it's already recognized as the regional center. And this is important because growth brings growth. The more it grew, the more it grew. And after the Civil War, all these Confederate soldiers, their land was worthless and they had nothing to live for, and they came over to Texas and they settled here. If you go down to the Confederate Cemetery there next to the Dallas Convention Center and you start reading gravestones, you see all these street names in Dallas, right, that are very common for us. Many of these were Confederate. And so there was huge Confederate presence here. And so many of the national Confederate reunions were held at Fair Park. And some of them were pretty major events. And so Dallas has always had this mix of people. It had these Southerners coming in, but the largest immigration was always from Kentucky and Tennessee, the Middle South, not from the Deep South. And so attitudes here tended to be more Middle South, more like Nashville, so to say. Or perhaps Lexington in Kentucky. Now, I want to talk about a series of things that happened to each of which had kind of boosted Dallas in its own way. In 1903, a famous pastor in Dallas by the name of George Truett. Now, George Truett was pastor of the First Baptist Church in Dallas. Now, First Baptist is an amazing place because in 100 years, it only had two pastors. There's no other church, I think, in America that's only had two pastors in 100 years. It had Truett and then for 49 and then W.A. Criswell for 51. Criswell was bound and determined. If they had to carry him in, he was bound and determined to be there longer than Truett. Anyway, George Truett says one day, in the sermon, he says, Dallas deserves a great humanitarian hospital and we are going to build it. And we're going to name it after Texas' most famous Baptist, Robert Baylor. And so there it sits today, Baylor Hospital. Even today, private hospital, it's still as large, even as the new Parkland, you can imagine. It's a huge operation. And one of the hospitals down there is, of course, the first one they built. It's called the George Truett Hospital, so it's very appropriate. But Baylor has been a Dallas institution and has done so much for Dallas. Also, the same is true in 1911. The Methodists, the Southern Methodists, remember the Civil War split many churches, and the Southern Methodists, it was called Methodist Episcopal Church South, MEC South. And they were headquartered in and had their great school and seminary in Nashville. It was a place called Vanderbilt. But Vanderbilt had all that money from the Vanderbilt family and wanted to go its own way. And so they said, we'd like to be independent now, even though they were started by the Methodists. And this happened to a number of schools. So the Methodist Episcopal Church South decided to look around for a new location. And they looked here and they looked there. And against all odds, they chose Dallas, Texas. There was really not that much here at that time, 1903, but they said they believed that this is where the future was. So they built that campus. When they built SMU, they were way out in the boonies. You know, there was nothing around for miles and miles. It was Dedman Hall, the old wing there. And now, imagine Dallas without SMU. I mean, they're so tightly tied together the way TCU is tied to Fort Worth. Anyway, so SMU came to Dallas. That was a tremendous boost to the economy. Then in 1911, there was something called the Kessler Plan. Kessler, the idea of Kessler, Kessler Park is named after Kessler. Kessler had this idea that Dallas should have a grand plan. And the idea was, first and foremost, to consolidate all the various railroad depots around town into one depot. And to be called Union Station. And then out of Union Station was supposed to be a grand boulevard. Shumsfield is a kind of boulevard that was going to be the centerpiece of Dallas. Well, the boulevard never came to fruition, but Union Station certainly did. And they had, now think about these numbers. In 1911, when it opened, it had 80 trains a day. And 9 railroad companies operated out of Union Station. This is extraordinary how big it was from the very beginning. And you could go, get on a train. In fact, in this very volume, 1900, you can see all these railroads advertising, and they'll say, overnight to St. Louis, overnight to Atlanta, overnight to New Orleans. And you could get, in some ways, Dallas is better connected then than it is today, because railroads could get you to these, you know, obscure destinations. Now we can take planes, but you have to go, you know, from one big place to the other big place and then try to find your way to where you're going. But anyway, so the railroad business was very big. In 1912, extraordinary circumstance happened. And that was this. There were a group of promoters who said Dallas, the thing Dallas needed was a world-class hotel. And how in the world could they finance a world-class hotel? And they talked about various people. They finally, somebody suggested, there's a man that has the money if he'll do it. I said, who's that? His name is Adolphus Bush. Adolphus Bush? Really? Where does he live? Well, he lives in St. Louis. And he has a brand you may have heard of called Budweiser. Adolphus Bush had made a fortune in Texas. Remember all those Germans settled, especially down in the hill country? And Budweiser was very popular among the Germans. And Adolphus Bush had been to Dallas and setting up distribution in Dallas, and he had invested. He invested in some real estate. That gave him the idea. Maybe he'd build a hotel. So this is kind of chutzpah. This kind of almost gall these Dallas citizens had to get on a train and go talk Adolphus Bush into building a great hotel here. So he meets with them and he says, "So what do you want?" "Well, we want you to build a great hotel in Dallas." So he said, "I've been to Dallas, nice place. Why do you want this hotel?" "Well, you know, Dallas needs a hotel. We don't have a good hotel. We just have some crappy little hotels." And so Adolphus Bush says, "Okay, I'll do it. I only have maybe two or three conditions." "What are they, sir?" "Well, the first condition is this. You have to build it. There's only one place I'll accept for you to be built. That's Quarter of Commerce and just like on the cross street where the Adolphus is, of course. And
Acker.
Thank you. Commerce and Acker. You have to build it in that corner. I want it on the northwest corner." "Well, sir, you know that City Hall." "Yeah, I know. But if you want it bad enough, you'll tear down City Hall and build it." "So we'll have to check on that. What are your other conditions?" "Well, I have two more. First of all, it has to be 22 stories high." "Okay, 22. I mean, we don't have a building that tall in Dallas, but that's fine. But why 22? And he said, "Well, there were 22 of us kids in the Bush family. And if they all come to visit, I want to have four for each of my siblings. One for me." "Okay. Anything else?" "Yes, it is something else. I want you to put a beautiful beer stein on top of the building." One of those gorgeous German beer steins, you know, decorating all this with a lid. So they went back and to Adolphus Bush's unbelief, they decided to tear down City Hall. They decided that they would do everything he asked for. So if you go down there today and you go over about a block away, you can stand there, count the stories, 22, and then on top is this huge beer stein, which nobody sees anymore because when you're driving along Commerce, you can't see it. And then right next to it is the Magnolia Building with the Flying Red Horse. Of course, Magnolia eventually became Mobil Oil. And then eventually Mobil Oil joined Standard Oil, which is called Exxon, in a great merger to become the largest oil company in the world, headquartered where? In Irving, which is, of course, nobody ever said, again, same thing. If you're in New York, you don't say, "Exxon's in Irving." You say, "Exxon's in Dallas." Just like the Dallas Cowboys were in Irving forever, right? Same thing. Yeah. I've got to write an article sometimes about all the things that are called Dallas that aren't in Dallas. Right? Yeah. And so we use a lot of that by saying, "Well, it's in Dallas County." See? So that's the way it goes. But anyway, that's how we got the Adolphus. And again, if you have a great hotel, then important people come, and you have a place to put them up, and they're impressed, and so on and so forth. By the way, the famous French Room restaurant at the Adolphus has been number one hotel restaurant in the official publication of hotels for the last, 15 years? I mean, it's an amazing record. The Adolphus, you know, it's in kind of a class by itself. And they had the famous Rainbow Room there, where they had the ice show that people would go see. Is anybody here old enough to remember the Rainbow Room? Or, excuse me, Century Room in the Adolphus? And Doc Franey the famous Olympic skater at that show there at the office for many years. Also, this same year, 1912, there's another important thing that happened, not so much in Dallas, but to a man from Dallas who then became world famous. This story, I'll try to keep it compact, but there was a pastor from St. Louis who came to take over a little church down in downtown Dallas. It was a little congregational church. And he came, and it was a very big success with his church, and it grew and grew and got bigger and bigger. And this man was well known around the country and even overseas as an evangelist. So this man would go every summer and spend the time in England. And while he was in Dallas and also traveling, he was working on a new kind of revolutionary Bible called the Study Bible. He invented the Study Bible. Study Bible is where you have the normal text of the Bible, and then down the middle you have the commentary. You explain what it means, right? So he took his idea, he finished his work, and he was on one of his trips in England, and he said to somebody there, what's the largest publishing company in England? He said, well, Oxford University Press. They also publish all the Bibles. And he said, where do I go? So they told him where to go, Oxford University. So he shows up there. This obscure pastor from Dallas, Texas, that nobody ever heard of, he shows up at Oxford University Press holding his Bible. And he said, I have a new kind of Bible here. Are you interested in publishing it? You know, this guy had no degrees, no credentials, nothing. And he never written anything else. He said, okay, we'll look at it. Somebody there took great interest. He said, you know, this is a great idea, a study Bible. We'll just give it a shot. We'll publish it. That study Bible was their biggest seller of all time. This was more than 100 years ago and still in print today. They've never been out of print. And of course, this is the famous Scofield Bible. C.I. Scofield was the pastor of the Dallas Church. And it was in 1912. What happened in 1912? April 14th and 15th. Well, of course, remember your history, that's when the Titanic went down on the 14th. No, it was hit the iceberg on the 14th and went down on the 15th. The reason I can remember those dates because those are exactly the same dates that Abraham Lincoln was shot on April 14th and he died on April 15th, just like the Titanic. So here he was. His fame was so great in England that they decided to have, you know, all these people from Belfast, Northern Ireland, where the Titanic had been built, had died, and so they decided to have one big mass funeral for everybody. Now, of all people in the world, who do they choose to lead that service, to preach at that service? Nobody other than C.I. Scofield, Dallas, Texas. That's amazing. And because he was much beloved, even more so probably in England than in America. Now, while he was here, he started a little Bible school called the Southwest Bible College. A man named Louis Schaefer took that over, and ultimately it morphed into, and he changed the name to Dallas Theological Seminary, DTS, which, of course, Dallas is, in the evangelical world, people know Dallas Theological Center, and Dallas because this was the great center of what's called dispensationalism. This was the doctrine that C.I. Scofield taught. Dispensationalism means that history, God has separated history into these dispensations of 5 or 6 or 7, depending on which system you're looking at. And this was the idea that God is calling the shots, and it doesn't matter what we do or don't do, that these dispensations are going to come. Of course, this comes right out of Calvinism. you know, this idea that God is in charge and we are not. Well, anyway, that's what happened in 1912. In 1913, you'll remember that Henry Ford had started selling the Model T in 1908. And here we are, just a few years later, he decides it's too expensive to ship Model Ts all over the world. So he decides to build plants. And he did one plant for the Southwest. Of all the places to choose, where does he choose? Dallas, Texas. And he builds a four-motor plant in what we call today Deep Ellum. And Deep Ellum there, for many years, he produced Model Ts. The way a Ford plant worked, it took all the raw materials to the top, and by gravity, everything came down, and then at the end of the whole process, a Model T would be driven out the door and to the dealership. So Dallas had a Ford motor plant, which later Ford moved the plant to East Grand. And so the Ford Motor Plant became the Adams Hat Company. So most of us that have been around Dallas a long time, you see that sign, Adams Hat. That building is so important that when they built 75 highway going north, they bent it around. They bent it around so they would not hit the Adams, so we didn't have to destroy the Adams Hat Factory. That's how important that building was. And is, yeah, most people in Dallas don't even know it's there. And there you can see what's left of an exactly designed Ford Motor Company. In 1914, America finally went to a central bank. Now, this was one of the enduring controversies of the Constitution, and later Hamilton and Jefferson fought about this, everybody fought about this, and there was a great antithesis to having a central bank. So they came up with a kind of a solution. You'll have to judge for yourself whether this was a good solution. They decided to have a central bank, but not call it that. They called it Federal Reserve. And then to make sure that there wasn't too much power concentrated in one place, they would put these central banks around the country. And there would be one in the Southwest. Everybody assumed it was going to New Orleans. New Orleans was a much bigger economic operator at that time than Dallas was. But again, the same story. Boosters went to Washington. They talked and talked and talked and talked them into doing it in Dallas. So Dallas then got the Federal Reserve. And that, of course, right near the Adolphus, right near Union Station, was a big, and that's why Dallas was always considered a money center. In the 1930s, even in the 1940s, Dallas was really the center of the petroleum finance business. All these big banks were here. It's a tragedy the whole banking thing collapsed in Dallas when it did, because Dallas had been a huge banking center for the country. By the way, on that 1960, just down the street from the Ford Motor Plant, the African-American community down in Deep Ellum, there were three and Dallas had three free towns, if you want to, is a name that's often used. In local parlance, the big one was called Deep Ellum, because it was deep into Elm Street, Deep Ellum. And down in that Deep Ellum area, the Knights of Pythias were a very important fraternal organization. And they decided to build their lodge. And they hired as an architect, you won't believe this, they hired as an architect the son-in-law of Booker T. Washington. So Booker T. Washington's only daughter lived here in Dallas, raised her family, and her husband was an architect. He designed that building. Most of us know it here, not as the Knights of Pythias Hall, but as Union Banker. Union Banker, and it's there. It's still there, but now they're building another monstrous apartment complex has kind of hidden it now. But Union Banker Building is one of the most historic buildings in Dallas. And this explains, by the way, why Booker T. Washington was here so often, because he came to see his daughter. And he spoke every year at the State Fair. And he would come, and of course everybody wanted to meet him and see him and so on. And of course, as you know, the great high school here, Booker T. Washington High School, arts magnet school nowadays. And so think about State Fair though in the 1920s. Here you had what they called Negro Day. So Dallas was so segregated that the African American people all went on one day. And now, are you ready? Then another day was Klan Day. Klan Day. Yeah, so only Klan went on that day. That gives you an idea. You know how big Fair Park is. Both those days they fill it up. And one year in Klan Day, 1920s, the Klan decided to ask Philip Sanger, the same Sanger, later Sanger Harris, right? The thing to come and be their keynote speaker. It never occurred to the stupid Klan that Philip Sanger was a Jew. But, you know, the Klan hated the Jews. They hated the Catholics. They hated the Blacks. They hated everybody, the Hispanic people. Anybody who wasn't white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant was the enemy. So he came and he gave a speech and they applauded and they thought it was just marvelous, and he went right on doing business. And again, part, you know, it's part of the tapestry, if you will, of Dallas and its history. In 1922, something else shows you how progressive Dallas was. In 1922, the city of Dallas started a radio station, WRR. The station is still on the air today, still owned by the city of Dallas, and plays classical music. It is the second oldest operating radio station in the United States. The first is in Pittsburgh, and then the second one is in Dallas, Texas. Now, if you ever needed evidence that Dallas wants to project an image of culture, I present to you WRR. This classical music station has been on there all these years, playing classical music to the community of Dallas. I mean, think about that. It's profound. There are no other cities in the United States that own classical music stations. It's usually some university someplace, right? And but here in Dallas, it's the place. And of course, the advertisements are all for Mercedes and Cadillac, you know,
what year,
for the elite.
What year did he start that?
1922, yeah. Oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you, I was talking about Klan Day. One year, the Imperial Wizard showed up. He was actually from Dallas. His name was Wesley Evans. And you like this, Dr. Baker. He was a cut-rate Dallas dentist. And he had risen up to be the head of the Ku Klux Klan. You know, the Klan had this resurrection in 1920. The original Klan had been started by Bedford Forrest. And so, again, more irony. So Forrest Avenue went all the way right down into Bear Park. There was the Forrest Avenue theater movie. So in the 1970s, the name was changed from Forrest Avenue, named after the hero of the Klan, to Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. How perfect is that? Yeah. And that, so there was I hate to say this, but there was a big Klan presence in this second resurrection in the 1920s that got inspired by a movie done by a Southerner named Griffith called Birth of a Nation. You want to see something racist to the core, watch that movie if you can stomach it, if you can get yourself through it. It's amazing. By the way, it was Ma Ferguson. Remember the story of Ma Ferguson? Couldn't run again, so he put up Ma Ferguson. And what Ma Ferguson defeated a guy named Felix Robertson, who was the Klan's candidate in Texas. So that's, you know, so she really did amazing things. She beat the Klan, and she was elected as a woman in Texas. Nobody did that again until Ann Richards, right? So that's extraordinary in the extreme. Now, I want to just then kind of bring this up to the present. There were some interesting innovations along the way. In 1931, Holland Park Village was built, and this was in the annals of malls. This was a great innovation. It was the first time. There had been shopping districts before, but there had never been one that it was turned in on itself, so that you could go from one store to the other, of course outside. And then later, of course, you have the inside malls, the most famous of which is North Park, still to this day the largest mall in Texas. And let's see, 1955, Dallas Scott, the only theater designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, the Dallas Theater Center. And Frank Lloyd Wright was in his 90s at that time. He had never designed a theater. He was very interested in how it would come out. So before the construction was done, they invited him to come see it. And he did, just before he died. And he came to the Dallas Theater Center there in Turtle Creek. And he, they knew that Frank Lloyd Wright hated elevators. Now this is amazing. This guy had designed a high-rise that was a mile tall. It was never built, of course. Never will be, I'm sure. But he just basically hated elevators. So he had not put an elevator in Dallas Theater Center. Well, they had to have an elevator to move all that equipment, right? So when he came, they put this police caution tape all around the part where the elevator was and said, "Now stay, still under construction, Mr. Wright, don't go in there." And so he never realized that they built a beautiful, he was going to have ramps, you know, can you imagine pushing him up ramps? So right between the ramps is where they built the elevator. And that's again one of the most famous buildings in Dallas. And then finally I would like to conclude on this story. And that is, of course, in the 1950s, Fort Worth, which has always, forever, had this young brother syndrome against the big brother Dallas, sibling rivalry. And so they were going to build a great international airport, great Southwest International Airport. And then they got the resources together and they built the thing. And Braniff was there and American was there. But who wasn't there? The people from Dallas. They would not come because it was in Tarrant County. So they would just go to Love Field. And Dallas killed it. So it died. And right the new airport, DFW, went right down the county line. So it was in Dallas and it was in Fort Worth. And that was okay. And that has survived. Because both cities would get the taxation. I was on a flight in the 1970s, early, taking off from Dallas, and I looked down and there was this huge runway. I said, "That's not connected to DFW. What's that?" And somebody next to me said, "Well, that's the old Great Southwest, the biggest white elephant of all time." It just died. Fort Worth just lost a fortune on that, but. They as a consolation prize, American moved its headquarters into Tech County, and that made them feel a little bit better. But that rivalry goes on. You know, when Dallas, for years, when I first came, I was talking about building a new opera center, a new concert hall for opera, and they couldn't get any money. Nobody could give any money. Nothing happened. And then the Bass family decided to build a great opera house for Fort Worth, which we call, you know, Bass Hall. It took about 3 months, and the money just poured in. And so now we have the great AT&T Center down there, and the Winster Opera House, courtesy in a lot of ways of Fort Worth. So it's been a bit of rivalry, but it's been beneficial to both cities, the motivator. because Dallas is not going to let Fort Worth be better than anything. And as you know, Fort Worth has done a real good job in certain areas, particularly in the arts. That Kimball Museum, they know about Kimball around the world. Who's ever heard of the Dallas Museum of Art, right? Yeah, even though it's actually a much bigger, in some ways, better museum. So I want to open this up to questions, and I know you have a protocol here how this happens.
Wait. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Do you want me to do that now? Okay, I'll do
it. I'm going to have to take the microphone and carry it around.
Okay.
Is that all right?
Yeah, let me do the cliffhanger. And that's okay. Because right. Somebody really may want to leave, and I hope this hasn't hung you up. But the cliffhanger is this. Does anybody know what the three great iconic institutions starting in Dallas were?
Are we disqualified?
Yeah, if you know, if you heard me before, you can. Shannon, you'll have to.
State Fair?
Yeah. State Fair, no, there have been many fairs before that.
A couple at the beginning, which, I don't know, it's like 7-Eleven Southland Corporation, and then Neiman Marcus. You mentioned Sanger Harris, Neiman Marcus. Is
okay, well, you got one.
Okay.
I'll come back to it, yes?
Well,
Texas Instruments is particularly famous because Jack Kilby invented a microchip there all by himself about 1957 or 6 in there. 58. Yeah, and that's, you know, he got the Nobel Prize for that. That's probably the biggest technological thing that ever happened in Texas. It's one of the great technological achievements of all time, yet Dallas, you know, gets a little credit for it because he was on summer. He didn't have enough time for summer vacation, so he's working on this problem. And then, of course, he came up with the first handheld computer calculator. So that was good. So that ought to be on the list, but I don't think it isn't quite have the impact. It should, but it isn't quite the impact of some other things. Anybody? You know, so you don't get the answer. Don't get the answer. Yes.
What's your guess? Well, in my guess, yes.
Okay.
My three favorites. Atlantic Airlines, Southwest Airlines, and Dr. Pepper.
Dr. Pepper. Okay, let's start with Dr. Pepper. It was, of course, started in Waco, in the old corner pharmacy there. And then, of course, it moved to Dallas as quickly as it could. But it was, we can't claim it. We can't claim it. Yes, sir.
How about Frito-Lay?
So Frito-Lay is another one of these great things that I would say, since it dominates the salty snack market in the entire, you know, country. But it's not necessarily well-known around the world. But it's certainly best-known snack food in the United States. Okay, so we have one. We have one. The first one is the world's first convenience store. Convenience store. So it was. Here's the story on that. So the Southland Ice Company was a purveyor of ice in Dallas area, and they what they built were these little neighborhood docks. They'd bring in the ice, and then there was a dock there where they could put the ice in the cars. And it was just a place, you know, convenient to drive up to and get your ice and go home. And what happened, the Southland Ice Company had a dock at the corner of 12th and Edgefield. And at the corner of 12th and Edgefield, people would come. And it was the only place open on Sunday because people needed ice on Sunday. Nothing else was allowed. Even when I came in the 1970s, the only thing open in Dallas County were pharmacies. And so people would said to the owner there, a man named, just a minute.
Thompson,
thank you. Thompson. Thompson, people kept saying, you need to sell a few little things, you know, like emergency things like milk and eggs and bread and, you know, Band-Aids and just simple things like that, just to have it. So he said, I'm going to give it a shot. So he started selling and it just went like crazy, right? They couldn't keep enough stuff in stock. So they sold their ice, but they also sold all this, started making more money on the convenience things they sold. And so they changed the name from Southland Ice to Totem. totem, you know, like the totem. And they were that totem for what, quite a while, and then they changed the name to 7-Eleven to emphasize they were open from 7 to 11, which was, at that time, a big deal. It's still the largest convenience chain in the world, and 30% of all 7-Elevens are in what country? Japan. Yeah. So that's the answer number one. Number two, yes?
How about the study Bible?
Well, the study Bible is again, it should be on the list of innovations that come out of Dallas, but it's known primarily in the religious world. It doesn't have like a proper culture impact. What I'm talking about is something everybody knows about. The answer, of course, is the world's first drive-in restaurant was in Oak Cliff. Funny that Oak Cliff has two out of the three. That, of course, was the corner of Fort Worth Avenue and Chalk Hill Road. Was, well, Sybil's is a little bit later. We'll talk about Sybil's. But anyway, it was called the Pig Stand Number One. Pig Stand. And they sold, which, you know, Texas is all beef, but they sold these pig sandwiches, which were a novelty. And the other novelty was people could drive up to the curb, and these young boys would run out and jump up on the running board. And they'd hop up on the running board, hence the word car-ha. So the word car-ha was these boys would take the order, run in, you know, get the food, run back out. And they had just a world of business because this is 1920, I should have this. But, very early, might even been a little bit earlier than that. Anyway, people would come in their Model T's and they would grab their food. So this took off like a rocket. So they started franchising and there were hundreds of pig stands. Pig stand number 23 was in San Bernardino, California. And the guy there wanted to try something. So he said, you know, I think it'd be really simple if we just opened up a window here and just handed the food as they drive by. So the first drive-in restaurant, although it was in California, was a pig stand franchised from Dallas, Texas. And they were enormously popular. The man, one of the men who started pig stand was named Kirby. And Kirby had the idea of a tray with little hooks on it that he'd bring out. And so then the idea of fast food drive-in restaurant just took off like crazy. The second one was in California. It's called A&W Root Beer. And there were many. Now, you mentioned Sybil's. Sybil's actually started as a knockoff of the pig stand in Houston and then moved to Oak Cliff at the corner where Davis and Fort Worth Avenue came together in a V, and there was quite a bit of land there. And Sybil's built what was then the largest drive-in restaurant in the country. They could accommodate, you can imagine this, over 500 cars.
Wow.
It was huge. And the girls, to be hired at Sybil's, you had to be young and gorgeous. And so people would come just to see the girls, right? And they were on roller skates, and they'd come out, and they got great tips. And, you know, it was kind of Hooters long before its time. And Sybil's, when I first came, it was already gone. This is almost 50 years ago now. But everybody was still talking about Sybil's. Oh, you should have seen Sybil's. So nothing like Sybil's. And so I was always disappointed I didn't get to see it. Number, yes?
The girls had to pay to work there.
Is that right?
The car off, sure.
Well, it was, yeah, because they got such great tips. Right. Yeah, and there are women living today that were young girls who were car house there at Sybil. And then the third great iconic institution, you know this, so mum's word, that actually started in 1917 in the Adolphus Hotel. And that is a group of men came together who wanted to create a service organization to help people. And they invented the Lions Club.
Oh, wow.
So Lions Club, of course, is known worldwide. What's interesting about Lions Club, if you go to another country, whatever the word for lion is in that country, so you have, they have many different names, but they've done all this amazing work, particularly with vision and glasses and eyesight and all this stuff. So we honor the, that's just 100 years ago this past year, 2017. All right, I got the cliffhangers in. And so here you go.
So entertaining. But, I hope you've written a book or will write a book, because you know so much history, so much detail. It's so entertaining. And I didn't want to interrupt you, but we don't have any time for questions. I'll entertain one question. Okay,
here we go.
You got one?
The question, it goes back to the Klan. You know, the Klan was, they were against gambling. And when the Dish was head of the Klan, he captured Benny Binion's main runner, took him down to the whipping tree down at Waxahachie, I mean, down in, I forget, Corsicana, and whipped him near to death and told him that if Benny Binion didn't get out of Dallas in a few days, they would take Benny Binion down there and whip him. Well, two or three days later, Benny Binion's men captured the head of the Ku Klux Klan on the what's that overpass north of the one that's been made into a...
Winnow Rogers.
The viaduct that's just north of the new one, the one that you got.
Oh,
the one that goes over to West Dallas. Ends up over there. The one north of that, the old one that's been made into a walkway. Anyway, they captured him. The Binion's men captured him there and took him down to his own whipping tree and whipped him near to death and told him if he didn't get out of town the next day, they'd kill him. So that dentist left town the next day.
I want to respond to that. Benny Binion, of course, his fame is because he was in business with a man named Fred Browning at a famous casino called Top of the Hill. In Arlington, and at Top of the Hill, they had gambling and prostitution in the 1930s and 1940s. And there are still people living today that went to this famous Top of the Hill casino, where they had tunnels underneath. And when the Texas Rangers would raid once in a while, they would run down into the tunnel and then exit. And nobody would, when the Rangers got there, nobody was there. Those tunnels, by the way, are still there if you want to go see them. Today it's called Arlington Baptist College, which is ironic, of course, that a casino became a Baptist college. But they do tell the history of it. If you go to Arlington Baptist, they'd love to tell you about it. But anyway, Benny Binion then did, in fact, leave Dallas, set up Top of the Hill casino setup in Las Vegas, and was one of the very first, under the name the Golden Horseshoe. And then his son took the idea and brought it to Bossier City, where he had the Jack Binion. Yeah. And so the Binions have been in the gambling business for a long time, but it all started at Top of the Hill in Arlington.
Now, there's a big article about all that history. I think it was in D Magazine a few months ago. Well, thank you very, very much. Woo!